Chapter 6. The bounty hunter awoke to find himself in a place of pain and darkness. Memory struggled to return to him, even as the chill of the damp stone floor bit into the bare flesh of his back and legs. Brunner clenched his jaw against the sudden red-hot rush of agony that shot through him as he rolled onto his side. The stirring memories told him that Corbus had done this to him, lifting his body like a rag doll and dashing him against the stone walls with the knight's inhuman strength. Yes, Corbus and the torturers who had assisted the monster had been very thorough, brutalizing their captive for several hours before tiring of their sport. If his cell was not absolutely without light, Brunner imagined that his body would seem like a gigantic bruise. More memories began to trickle in. The red-gowned witch who had stood beside Duke Marimond in the throne room and who had later come to the torture chamber to remind Sir Corbus that their mutual lord and master did not want their prisoner killed. He remembered Corbus's snarled oath that they were simply softening him up, that they wouldn't even start asking questions until the next day. The witch had grown angry at the knight's surly, unapologetic remark, but had held her tongue, her strange eyes narrowing with a mixture of caution and fear. Brunner slid his battered body across the floor, biting down on another cry of pain as his scarred back met a stone-cold wall. He turned his face in the direction in which memory told him the door of the cell lay. He knew that two men had been left to guard him, men who had seemed properly motivated when Corbus had informed them to keep a careful watch on the prisoner. Brunner strained his ears to detect any sign that the guards had heard him. He needed time to think, time to work out some plan of action, and time to begin recovering from his injuries. The bounty hunter worried that if the guards knew that he had awoken, they might fetch Sir Corbus, so the inhuman knight could again sate his wounded pride with another round of torture. The sound of movement and a flicker of light in the hall outside his cell brought a curse rolling from Brunner. Since arriving in Mousillon, he had nothing but ill luck and misfortune. Perhaps that was the real reason the city was called Cursed. He'd wondered why his captors had not bothered to shackle him to the wall. Now he had his answer. Because Corbus did not intend him to stay in the cell for very long. The bounty hunter groaned as he struggled to his feet, forcing his protesting body to obey. He folded his hands together, making a hammer from his locked fists. If they thought to drag him from the cell, they would not do so unopposed. The light grew brighter behind the door, shining through the narrow barred window, illuminating for Brunner the small extent of the miserable hole in which Corbus had discarded him. The bounty hunter braced himself against the wall as he heard the sound of iron keys rattling. Slowly, the door began to inch open. Brunner did not wait a moment, lurching clumsily at a retreating portal and pushing it outward as fast and violently as he could. The bounty hunter knew the rushed attack was foolhardy, but had decided that even if his bravado were rewarded with a sword in his gut, it would still be a much quicker end than being left to the mercies of Corbus. Brunner's lunge forced whoever had opened the door to retreat to the far wall of the corridor to avoid being struck by the hurtling portal. He stumbled after the retreating figure, bringing his locked fists over his head in order to drive them into the skull of his enemy with the maximum amount of force. Brunner paused in his attack, however, when he found that he faced not one of Marimond's guards, but the witch who had shown such marked interest in him since his arrival in the castle. Now that he saw her up close, Without Corbus's fist smashing into his face every few seconds, Brunner saw the source of the unsettling grace which had haunted the woman's movements, the strange beauty that had characterized his impression of her. Merriman's enchantress was an elf, something that did little to ease Brunner's mind regarding his chances of escape. Even when dealt with from a position of strength, elves were dangerous folk to trifle with. Their minds were far older than those of men. Filled with secret knowledge, even the wisest wizard would find difficult to comprehend. Their bodies possessed of an agility and quickness that made a mockery of even the most skilled acrobats. Brunner saw that Merriman's witch had replaced her red robes with a tight-fitting leather tunic, breeches, and knee-high boots. There was nothing about her lean, supple form to suggest the physical weakness and frailty of those human sorcerers Brunner had encountered in his travels.
"Stay your hand, Brunner,"
the witch commanded, her piercing eyes fixed upon the bounty hunters.
"I have come to help you,"
she told him.
"My name is Ithilwale. I have put a powder in the guards' wine that will make them sleep for hours."
"Why would you help me?" Brunner demanded, his voice filled with suspicion. He kept his locked fists raised, though with the element of surprise gone, he doubted if he would be able to do as much as touch the wiry elf woman. "You are Merriman's sorceress. You told him I was coming."
"Yes,"
Ithilwale admitted, nodding her head in apology.
"It was I who told the Duke about your intentions."
The elf's face twisted into an embarrassed smile.
"I have my reasons for not wishing to see Merriman dead."
This last was spoken in such a manner that it was obvious to Brunner there was no love lost between Merriman and his enchantress. "You fear Corbus," the bounty hunter observed. A faint trace of the fear he had seen there briefly before flickered in the elf's eyes.
"Corbus is a monster, a foul perversion of the blackest sorcery,"
Ithilwale stated.
"Only men with their short lives and shorter vision could have imagined such a loathsome use of magic."
The elf shook her head, sickened by the mere contemplation of such things.
"Corbus is one of the undead, a vampire. He clings to the martial pride and chivalry honor that were his in life, using them to try to prevent being completely devoured by the terrible urges that torment him. He took service with Merriman shortly after arriving in Musilon. It is that oath of service that gives Merriman control over his vampire."
Brunner fought not to show the horror which gnawed at his gut. He had had encounters with the undead before, and had always found their chief weakness lay in their lack of skill as warriors. But he'd seen Corbus in action, seen him to be perhaps the finest swordsman the bounty hunter had ever encountered. To learn that the unholy powers of the vampire were behind that blade. Brunner decided that the greater the distance he put between himself and Sir Corbus, the better.
"That explains why you didn't want me to kill Merriman," Brunner said. "But it does not answer my question. Why free me afterwards?"
Ithilwale took a step toward the bounty hunter, reaching forward with a slender hand, the pale flesh hovering inches from Brunner's discolored chest.
"Because I need your help,"
she confessed.
"I am as much a prisoner here as yourself. I was aboard one of my people's ships, a research expedition dispatched by the Archmages of Seyfery. We were to collect specimens of the strange plants that the mystics of Araby employ in their crude experiments, but there was a terrible storm, one even our magic had not foreseen. The storm blew our vessel north, at last driving the ship into the mud banks that surround Musilon. Though the city had an ill air about it, we decided to seek the assistance of its denizens in repairing our ship. The first poor wretches we saw fled at our approach, taking us to be demons. But it was not long before they returned in huge, howling mobs. They blocked our escape back to the mudflats, filling the streets and alleys behind us with their numbers. It was with great reluctance that the warriors among us lashed out, so miserable and dejected were their foes, and it was that reluctance that doomed them. They waited too long, letting the mob draw too close. One by one they were dragged down and ripped apart by fishbone knives and driftwood spears. The rest of us fled the only way we could, retreating deeper into the city. But we found no refuge there. In the end, only I escaped. My flight had taken me to an old, decaying stone chapel. I had sensed the sleeping power of the place, a faint echo of a magic that was kindred to my own. There was a man in the chapel, an armored knight. It was Merrymand, and he at once demanded to know why I had disturbed his devotions. I explained as well as I could what had happened, thankful that this man, at least, seemed rational. Merrymand was silent for a moment, as he considered my story. When he spoke, it was to offer me protection if I served him. With the sound of the pursuing mob drawing close to the chapel, I had no choice but to accept his offer. In exchange for my magical talents, Merrymand keeps me safe from the superstitious peasants and from the soldiers of the other nobles, who hate and fear me as the Red Enchantress. I must escape. Time for me is running out.
Ithilwail continued, her voice filled with dread.
But I fear to do so on my own. I do not know my way through the city. Merrymand has always been careful to keep me within the walls of the castle. And my skill lies not with the sword, were I to encounter trouble. I need a strong, skilled warrior to take me from this accursed place.
Her eyes took on a crafty quality as they stared deeper into Brunner's.
One who has just as pressing a need to be far away from this place as I.
She reached into a pouch fitted to the belt that crossed her waist, her hand emerging with a lump of dun-colored paste.
This healing salve will restore your strength and ease your wounds, she told the bounty hunter. Agree to help me, and I shall administer it to you.
Brunner was quiet for a moment. He was not certain just how much of the enchantress's tale he could trust. She had betrayed him to her master once before, and Brunner could tell that there was something she was not telling him. Perhaps his escape was nothing more than an elaborate hoax, a way for her to outshine Corbus in the esteem of their master. Brunner considered the possibility, then shrugged his shoulders, a motion that caused a fresh jolt of pain to surge through his body. He had nothing to lose by accepting Ithilwail's terms.
I agree, he told the elf.
Ithilwail smiled at him, her pale hand lighting upon his forearm, kneading the paste into his skin. Brunner could feel his flesh tingle as the paste did its work, numbing the pain.
I have brought the uniform of one of the guards, Ithilwail said, moving her ministrations to the bounty killer's scarred chest.
Brunner winced as her fingers passed over a jagged slash that recalled to him the brutal strength of the orc warlord, Nasharrak. The elf did not pause, knowing that the bounty hunter's discomfort had no connection to her salve.
You are much more likely to pass unnoticed, dressed as one of the guards,
Ithilwail continued, a slight flush coming to her graceful features.
Then you are clad in naught but a loincloth.
Brunner nodded his head in agreement.
So long as you brought along his sword as well, the bounty hunter told her. I do not intend to be recaptured.
Several minutes later, Brunner slid the mail coif over his head, completing his transformation from prisoner to guard. The bounty hunter tossed aside the heavy kettle helm, which had proven too large for him.
Perhaps the guard to which it belonged suffered from a swelled head, even when he wasn't drinking drugged wine. Brunner grinned as he gripped the longsword that went with the uniform, carefully studying its balance.
"Any idea where Merrimond took my own sword?" Brunner asked, as he made a few practice swipes with his new weapon.
"He has taken your equipment to his own chambers,"
Ithilwale told the bounty hunter.
"Merrimond was impressed by the unique character and foreign cast of your arms and armor. He is obsessed with all things magical, and no doubt intends to compare them with the enchanted devices illustrated in the many scrolls and books he has collected."
Brunner stopped practicing with the stolen sword. He fixed the elf woman with a demanding stare.
"How well guarded are the Duke's quarters?"
"When Duke Merrimond is within them, very well guarded,"
Ithilwale told him.
"However, I have arranged for the Duke to be occupied elsewhere in the castle, a minor enchantment I arranged that should keep him distracted for a while. With him gone, there should only be 2 guards."
Brunner nodded his head.
2 men should not prove an insurmountable challenge."
A skeptical smile broadened across the bounty hunter's face when he looked back at the enchantress.
"Why did you arrange this distraction? How did you know I would ask after my belongings and not simply drag you to the nearest exit? What is it that you are looking to steal from Merrimond?"
Ithilwale took her time in answering, her eyes narrowing with annoyance that the bounty hunter continued to treat her with such suspicion, and annoyed that she now had to give voice to the fear that had been gnawing at her for days, the fear that had at last spurred her to action.
"Several days ago," the elf said at last, "Merrimond captured another prisoner, a petty thief who led the Duke's wife astray some years in the past. This thief had on him a device, a magical talisman crafted by my people."
The elf's features became stern, as unyielding as marble.
"I cannot leave here without it."
The bounty hunter pondered Ithilwale's confession.
"It was from this thief that you learned of me? He told you that I was hunting him? That is how you knew my name?"
"Yes," Ithilwale admitted. "When I heard the story of how you helped Corbus, I knew that you had made a deal with the other aristocrats, and there were only 3 people in this castle they hate enough to see assassinated. I could not trust to luck that it was Corbus they wanted dead."
Brunner waved aside Ithilwale's explanation.
"If this dog still lives, I want you to take me to him."
The bounty hunter clenched his fist in anticipation of the gold Gobineau would bring him when he got a rogue back to Carone.
"He is not important," the elf protested. "Leave him to Merrimond. It is more important that we get the Fell Fang and escape."
"He is important to me,"
Brunner countered.
"As for this artifact of yours, we'll still make a detour in our escape to collect it. If Merrimond has promised Gobineau as pleasant a stay here as he did myself, we may even find him most eager to help us."
Ithilwale opened her mouth to argue, but the bounty hunter motioned her to silence, gesturing for her to lead the way. Gobineau stirred within his cell, alarmed by the sounds emanating from the corridor outside. Had Merrimond decided his fate already? The rogue ground his teeth together. He knew that he shouldn't have trusted the elf witch. With a fatalistic sigh, Gobineau watched as the faint gleam of torchlight began to grow in the window of his cell. The door swung open, revealing the elf witch. Gobineau stared for a moment, drinking in the sight of her lithe body in its new covering of leather, much more appealing than the voluminous red gown she had worn on their first meeting. So enthralled was he by Ithilwale's slender figure that Gobineau did not notice the armed guard with her until the man made his way into the cell. The rogue quickly forgot about the elf's shapely body when he sighted the sword clutched in the soldier's fist. Gobineau flinched away from the bared weapon, squirming against the wall. The guard fixed Gobineau with a stern gaze, his icy eyes boring into the bandit's own. Hastily concocted pleas and entreaties died on the tip of Gobineau's tongue. A man with such eyes as these was beyond calls of mercy and promises of gratitude. There was more chance in reasoning with a wolf. The warrior spoke in a harsh, brutal tone. "Do you want to live?" For the first time, Gobineau noticed the set of iron keys gripped in the guard's other hand. "After careful deliberation, I would have to answer yes," the rogue told him. He did not have any idea what was going on, but anything that would see him unchained had to be an improvement. The guard continued to glare at the prisoner, making no move to unlock his chains.
"If I free you, will you do as I say until we have made our escape, upon whatever gods you honor?"
"You cannot trust him," Ithilwale stated from the doorway. "Time is short. Leave him."
He scowled at her, then returned his attention to the soldier. "If it means seeing this castle at my back, you can tell me to walk on fire, and I would just start walking," Gobineau declared. The guard considered him for a moment longer, then unlocked the manacles fixed to the rogue's wrists and the iron bindings that crossed his waist. Ithilwale uttered a sharp whistle of disapproval from the hallway.
"By the lady,"
Gobineau crowed, massaging his wrists.
"You'll not regret this. My gratitude and friendship are legendary across all of Bretonnia. I'm in your debt and shall never be able to repay you, though I shall endeavor to do so until the crows come for my eyes and the worms nip at my feet."
"You can make a start by shutting that flapping mouth of yours,"
the guard growled, turning to leave the cell.
"One question," Gobineau said, hurrying to keep pace with his rescuer. "Why free me? Not that I'm complaining," he hastily added.
The guard shot Ithilwale a warning look.
"Strength in numbers," he told the rogue. "The more people Marimond is looking for, the less likely he is to catch them."
The soldier tossed the keyring aside, the iron ring clattering down the corridor as it rattled its way into the darkness.
"Besides," he added, "I don't trust the elf."
That, at least, Gobineau decided, sounded very close to the truth. Ithilwale walked at the rear of their small procession, her face contorted with misgiving. Perhaps she had made a mistake in pinning her hopes on the bounty hunter. Brunner seemed intent on only one thing, securing the gold he hoped to gain when he returned Gobineau to the royal court in Caronne. He was hardly the noble hero she desperately needed, nothing more than a mercenary parasite, a lone wolf intent only on filling his own belly. Still, there was little chance that she would have another opportunity. There was small hope that one of her own people would miraculously appear in Mousillon, let alone survive the superstitious mob that had claimed her own shipmates. She might hope for one of the wandering knights of Bretonnia to arrive, but after seeing the examples of Bretonnia's knighthood that Mousillon had presented her, she could hardly take any comfort in that possibility either. In any event, time was running much too short. She had to act now. The Fell Fang. It was little more than a legend, a sorcerous device crafted long ago by disillusioned princes from the realm of Kalador. Kalador had once been the mightiest of the realms of Ulthuan, and the elf princes of that land had ridden to war upon the backs of their mighty allies, the dragons who dwelt in the mountains of Calador. But over the ages, the dragons had fallen into deep slumber, so that fewer and fewer of them would answer the call to battle and war. Some among the nobility of Calador had resented the waning might of their realm that resulted from the long slumber of their allies. A faction had set out to restore their prestige by crafting sorcerous talismans that bound the sleeping dragons to their will, enslaving them and forcing them to rouse when their masters called upon them. But such a reckless and greedy use of magic had been deemed not only cruel and dangerous by the other princes of Calador and the archmages of Safari, but also a despicable act of treachery, upon which creatures who had been and still were the friends and allies of the elves. The disillusioned princes had been exiled, branded as the Grey Lords, never to set eyes upon the shores of Ulthuan again. If Ilwael had studied the great books of lore kept in the Tower of Hoef, in her native Ulthuan, and in those books she had learned of the Fel Fang. The thing that Gobineau had brought with him looked very much like it, too much so to be mere coincidence. One of the exiled Grey Lords must have made his home in the colonies that had once existed in the lands of Bretonnia, and he must also have continued his experiments with the dangerous sorcery he and his fellow renegades had proposed. Now Merrimond had in his possession a device of such awful potency that he could not even begin to appreciate it, even if he understood what it was. The Fel Fang had been intended to enslave the dragon to which it was bound, but even the strongest willed of the Grey Lords had found such control beyond them. They could rouse the worms from their slumber, this much they had achieved, and they could even manage to communicate with the reptiles, their minds touching upon those of the ancient creatures in a spectral communion. But true control was beyond them, and the ire of the dragons, when forced from their sleep, had been a thing to bring nightmares even when dulled by centuries of memory. How much worse should it be were an unthinking, unknowing man call upon such forces without even the slightest idea of what he did. An entire nation might burn if the dragon bound to the Fel Fang were to stir. There was another danger as well. Corbus, Merriman's pet vampire. The undead knight had once been a noble and heroic example of his kind, if the history she had heard the monster speak was more than simple lies. Corbus had taken up the quest, riding across the green lands of Bretonnia, answering the challenges of man and monster as he found them, hoping that he might prove worthy enough to find the sacred grail of his land's patron goddess, the Lady of the Lake. But in his quest, he had been brought low, his courage and valor proven to be wanting and unworthy. He had encountered a black-armored knight in the shadows of a haunted forest. He had answered the rival knight's challenge, and had contested his foe in combat for nearly an hour before his rival had struck him down. But the blessing of an honorable death was not to be for Sir Corbus. The other knight had removed his helm, revealing the pale features and elongated fangs of a vampire. Corbus had impressed the vampire enough that it had decided that he must share in its curse. Corbus had been inducted in the Foul Order of the Blood Dragons, a brotherhood of vampiric knights who existed by their own twisted code of honor, a perverse mockery of the chivalry and martial pride that had filled them in life. They existed only to find foes worthy enough to face them in combat, the search for even greater challenges the only motivation in the dark and miserable midnight of their existence, despising and hating the loathsome, uncontrollable monsters they had become. Corbus had forsaken his quest, slinking to Musilon, the city that had been cursed by Malford's false grail, the only place in Bretonia vile enough to endure the beast he had become. The vampire knight had found service with Duke Marimond. Desperately clinging to the oaths of service and loyalty, he had sworn to the nobleman, as if they were the final bridge between the monster he was and the man he had been. But all of that would change if Corbus were to find out what Marimond had. The vampire had not been there when Gobineau had told the Duke what the artifact was and what it was reportedly able to do. Marimond himself had not believed the rogue's wagging tongue, but Corbus would have. The blood dragon would have seized upon it with the same desperation a drowning man would a floating piece of wood. For there was a tradition, a myth common to the accursed order of vampiric knights. If ever one of them should taste the fiery blood that flowed through the veins of a dragon, then that vampire would never again be stricken by the red thirst, never again feel the need to slake his unholy hunger upon the blood of the living. To achieve such a thing, Ithil well knew, the vampire would do anything. He would be beyond anyone's control. Even the oaths he had sworn to Marimond would not restrain him if he thought that he might rid himself of the curse. No, Corbus would seize the fell fang and use it the instant he learned of it. Ithilwell shuddered as she considered what that might mean. The vampire would call up a monster that would be beyond its control, beyond anyone's control, a monster that would seek out and destroy the fool that had called it, and anything else it found in the vicinity. She would have to trust that it was not already too late, that Corbus had not somehow learned what his master possessed, and that Marimond himself had not been toying with the dreaded artifact. The trio continued to make their way through the narrow maze of corridors that led upwards from Merriman's dungeons, past dingy cells and iron-doored storerooms, and the faded tapestries that hung like moldy cobwebs from the dank stone walls. Ithilwell had directed Brunner to the safest route, the one that held the least possibility of being patrolled at such a late hour. True to her word, the halls had been empty of life. Now, if the path she had chosen to bring them to Marimond's chambers was as easily achieved, Brunner would be extremely content. A sudden smell brought them to a stop. Ithilwell's face contorted as the full reek struck her more discerning senses. Gobineau fell back a step, trying to place both the guard and the witch between himself and the corridor ahead. Brunner firmed his grip upon his sword, shooting a warning look at Gobineau as he stalked forward, reminding the rogue that whatever else might occur, he was not going to be forgotten. A short, dark shape shambled into view, the stink increasing as it did so. There was a gleam of steel in its hands, the razor-keen edge of a massive axe. Brunner shifted his stance so that he might better be able to address the difference in height should trouble occur.
"Hand over that scum,"
the shape snarled,
"or I'll see your heads lying on the floor."
"You're late," Brunner replied. The dark shadow crooked its head, staring at the man who had spoken. A grim chuckle rolled from the dwarf.
"I didn't recognize you, Brunner."
Olgrin laughed.
"A good disguise."
The dwarf gestured with his axe at Gobineau.
"I see you've saved me the trouble of fetching him."
The bounty hunter spun, kicking out with his leg as Gobineau braced himself to flee back down the hall. Brunner's foot struck the rogue's knee, spilling the prisoner to the floor amid a flurry of curses and snarls. He loomed over the prone man, the steel edge of the blade hovering near Gobineau's throat.
"He was playing nice until you gave the game away," Brunner snarled at the dwarf. "Now I'll have to watch him twice as carefully."
He leaned forward, letting the blade touch the soft skin of Gobineau's neck.
Or we could just settle for the reward his head will fetch.
The rogue went pale as he heard Brunner's words, bald fists opening into empty hands.
Do you know this disgusting creature?
Ithilwale interrupted, her features trying to conceal the horror she felt as her senses were assaulted by Ulgrin's smell and filth-crusted appearance.
My partner,
Brunner informed her.
Ulgrin Baelax, renowned dwarf huntsman and mercenary.
Ithilwale stared even more intently at the muck-crusted figure. She'd read many accounts of the terrible war between her people and the stubbornly vindictive and irrational dwarves, but had never actually seen one before. She rubbed at her nose as Ulgrin's stink continued to assail her. She had never imagined them to be so disgusting, wallowing, it seemed, in their own filth. Suddenly, war between her people and these foul tunnel rats did not seem so tragic as inevitable. Indeed, she marveled that there had ever been peace between her kind and such offenses against nature.
I don't suppose you could shoo him away?
Ithilwale asked, her voice distorted by the fingers, pinching her nose closed.
Not after what I've gone through to get here.
Ulgrin cursed. The dwarf gestured again with his axe, this time at the other bounty hunter. A clump of filth tumbled from Olgrin's arm.
I've had to hide from ghouls, sneak past ghosts, and hack apart a street just to get here. Then I get half-drowned by a geyser of filth before crawling through a muck hole no wider than a cartwheel.
The dwarf patted at a blackened patch of mud that had once been his beard.
And don't even get me started about the frogs.
He snorted.
Those damn things are going to cost you 50 gold each.
Brunner's eyes narrowed, his mouth becoming a straight-edged line.
We agreed on 1,000, and 1,000 it stands.
He warned. Ulgrin took a threatening step forward. An expectant silence drifted between the two bounty hunters for a moment before the slender shape of Ithilwale interposed itself between them.
You can argue over gold later,
the elf said, her angry glare encompassing both man and dwarf, an aroused temper overwhelming even her offended senses.
After we do what has to be done and escape this place.
Brunner and Ulgrin slowly looked away from one another, each of them casting a surly look at the enchantress. At length, Ulgrin shrugged his shoulders, adopting a less combative stance.
My ancestors would skin me for saying it,
the dwarf hissed,
but Tall Ears here is right. Best we settle this when the timing is better. But I can tell you right now, I'm not splitting my reward with an elf.
Ulgrin tipped his head, indicating the way he had come.
I'll lead you to the tunnel, but if we run into more frogs, you're the one who gets to play with them. I'm not touching another one unless we agree on how much they are worth first.
Ulgrin turned to begin to lead the way out.
We're not leaving yet, Brunner said.
The statement brought looks of shock to the faces of Ulgrin and Gobineau.
Not leaving?
The dwarf sputtered incredulously.
Why not?
He demanded.
If there is some sort of disagreement,
Gobineau said, rising to his feet,
why don't I go with the dwarf? And you can go off and do whatever you have to do here.
The rogue put on his most disarming smile.
I can assure you, I'm as eager as anybody to get away from Marimond, even if it means a hanging in Corone.
Brunner turned to glower at his prisoner.
I trust you out of my sight about as much as I trust a hungry halfling at a pantry.
The bounty hunter looked back toward Olgrin. "I'm not leaving here without my sword," he told the dwarf. "Ithilwale knows where Merrymunt put it. I'd rather have you with me on this than kill you over it." Olgrin chuckled at the bounty hunter's words.
"Kill me? I think you've got a distorted opinion of how that particular fracas would resolve."
The dwarf smiled beneath the filth crusting his beard.
"But I might help you with this foolishness you are set on. For another 100 gold to my share. And another 10 for any more frogs I have to kill."
Brunner eyed the dwarf for a long moment, then nodded his head.
"Watch the thief," he muttered as he pushed past Olgrin, motioning for Ithilwale to again lead away.
Olgrin laughed, slinging his axe so that it once again rested on his shoulder. The dwarf took up position at the rear of the odd procession.
10 gold for a frog," Gobineau whistled as he walked in front of Olgrin. "That has to be an even bigger act of robbery than anything I ever tried."
"You haven't seen the size of those frogs,"
Olgrin snarled back. Gobineau stopped, favoring the dwarf with an embarrassed smile.
"I'm sorry, but do you mind switching places? I'm afraid you're standing upwind," the rogue told him.
Olgrin sighed deeply, taking a step forward before realizing what he was doing. With another snarl, the dwarf pushed Gobineau forward.
"Well, it was worth a try,"
Gobineau commented. Sir Corbus descended the narrow stairs that led from Merriman's cellars to the dungeons. The vampire's mood was foul, the thirst burning in his veins. It had all been that miserable elf witch's doing. She'd placed some sort of enchantment upon one of the duke's cisterns, causing it to change water into wine. Merriman was entirely enthralled by the spectacle, ordering every cask and barrel in the castle brought down and filled. Corbus didn't trust the witch, and wondered what sort of trick she was playing at. Perhaps the enchantment would only last for a few hours, or perhaps the wine would all change back when dawn broke. There was some sort of mischief in her magic, of that he was certain. Her excuse that her efforts had worn her out, and that she needed to sleep and restore herself, had rung hollow in his ears as well. Still, Merrymunt had been too engaged to pay her departure any notice. That was just as well. She would not be there to mollify him when the magic at last failed, and then Corbus would have the pleasure of seeing her try to appease the duke's anger. Such a sight would bring Corbus a great deal of pleasure, not the least reason being the way the sight of all the churning red liquid filling the cistern had awoken his own thirsts. Corbus exited precariously, striving to control and subjugate the unholy hunger that always threatened to consume him. It was an effort not to fall upon fallen enemies, like a feral beast, a torment not to rip open the throat of a peasant in the street and drain her of her life's blood. But Corbus did manage to exert some control, denying his hungers as long as he could, until at last they built up within him to such a degree that it seemed he must burst from the pent-up demand. Then he would indulge his abominable hunger, falling upon the wretched prisoners Merrymunt kept in the dungeons for just such a purpose. The vampire stalked into the guard room that opened into the lower dungeons, then stopped. His eyes blazed into crimson embers when he saw the 2 men-at-arms lying asleep on the floor. Striding forward, Corbus lifted both men from the ground, one in either hand, and shook them like rag dolls until they awakened. Their stupor vanished in an instant, their eyes growing wide with horror as the vampire's enraged countenance glared at them.
you shall wish your mother's baron for this dereliction." Corbus roared. He flung one of the soldiers from him, the man crashing against a table that stood at the center of the room.
"Go and check on the prisoners!"
Corbus snarled as the guard rolled out from the wreckage. The man-at-arms scrambled out of the door that connected with the cells. A few moments later he returned, his face paler even than Corbus's undead flesh.
The assassin!"
the soldier sputtered.
"And the one who..."
"Go and tell the Duke about the escaped prisoners,"
Corbus roared. As the vampire spoke, his powerful grip intensified, snapping the neck of the guard he still held. The soldier's body shuddered and twitched as life fluttered from it. The other guard needed no further encouragement, racing past Corbus and toward the cellars. The vampire's fury blazed within his cold body. So, the elf bitch was feeling tired after her efforts? Corbus would make her suffer for betraying their master, the faithless witch. The undead knight sank his teeth into the neck of the still twitching body, gripped in his hand. The dying man's warm blood coursed into the emptiness of the vampire's husk. Corbus did not intend to satiate his thirst, just sip enough to make his hunger more keen, to make his senses sharper. He would find the assassin, and the adulterer, and the elf witch. Between the three of them, the vampire intended to have a full belly indeed. Duke Merriman's private chambers were opulent, by the impoverished standards of the aristocrats of Mousillon. The floors were covered in rugs of bearskin and shaggy windswept hide, and even included a few patterned carpets from distant Araby, quietly rotting relics from Mousillon's prosperous past. The furnishings were likewise relics, dark wood from Estalia, the Drakwald, and even more distant lands, carved by skilled artisans so that every inch of their surface was engraved. In one corner, a suit of armor, worn by a distant ancestor of Merriman's, stood in solemn silence, the grail standing out in bright gold upon the steel breastplate, testament to the heights of chivalry and virtue the dead worthy had achieved. A great marble fireplace stood against one wall, bronze lions flanking it, their forepaws raised in challenge. A mahogany bath stood in another corner, a patterned screen imported from Tylea standing beside it. One large bookcase held a variety of curious objects. A small rusty dagger, a wickedly grinning wooden fetish, a battered shield. These were the enchanted relics Merriman had acquired down through the years, items about which the aura of magic had gathered. Upon a large table were strewn the oddities the Duke had collected more recently, those which he had yet to determine if they warranted a place in his collection. Here rested the arms and armor of the bounty hunter, a dragon-hilted sword, a dented steel helm, a breastplate of Gromril. Beyond those things, taken from the bounty hunter, there were only a few other curios. One of these rested near the edge of the table, a long cylinder of ivory, engraved with strange lettering and curious carvings. Merriman had discovered the secret of the cylinder, twisting it open to expose the strange relic that lay within, a darkened crescent of hollow bone. This sat beside its casing, forlorn and forgotten.